we as refugees here in Gaza, we said to the Israeli occupation, we will get back to our land. If it's not today, tomorrow, if it's not us, our children. So this right won't fall down.
Every year, as Palestinians mark the Nakba, they are not only commemorating the horrors that took place 75 years ago and the demolition of some 500 villages and towns, they are also marking the Nakba, or catastrophe, that continues in different forms to this day. Last Tuesday, the Israeli regime launched a five-day onslaught on the Gaza Strip, killing and maiming scores of Palestinians, including innocent women and children.
The Palestinian Nakba of 1948 is still continuing. We can see this every day here in Gaza. The last few days, the Israelis have attacked the 2.3 million innocent Palestinians, killed 33 Palestinians, wounded dozens, destroyed dozens of houses.
Nakba Day is commemorated annually by Palestinians and by millions of those who support them and their cause around the world.
Nakba Day is special for the people of Gaza, where most of the inhabitants are refugees and children of refugees. Despite decades of displacement, they refuse to give up the right of return to their hometowns and villages. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
In Canada's largest city, young Palestinians have taken the lead in remembering 75 years of resistance and the ongoing displacement and dispossession faced by Palestinians with the commemoration of Nakba Day in the streets of downtown Toronto.
The Zionists once upon a time said that the older generation will die and that the youth will forget. And we are here today proving not only that the youth will not forget, but that the youth will take up an active role in our people's struggle for national liberation. We believe that we have a responsibility to confront Zionism in our locales, wherever Zionism is.
Well, 75 years of occupation, 75 years of crimes against humanity. We're here to stand in solidarity with the Palestinian people. And we want liberation. We believe that we are the generation of liberation.
Journalist Shireen Abu Akleh, murdered by Israeli troops 1 year ago, and political prisoner Kader Adnan were remembered among the numerous martyred and hundreds injured since the start of the year in historic Palestine amid an increase of violence by the Zionist occupation forces.
In the West Bank, we have seen continuous raids on cities like Jenin and Nablus, and these attempts have been to quell the youth that is rising up, resisting the settler colonial state that is taking away their rights and their right to live in dignity. We have seen home demolitions across historic Palestine in 48, in Al-Naqab, in Sheikh Jarrah. We have seen Palestinians being displaced. We have seen political prisoners succumb to their to medical negligence, a policy implemented by the Zionist entity intended to make sure that our political prisoners are effectively being slowly assassinated.
And so we are here saying that our prisoners carry the struggle forward and are our compass, that we will honor our martyrs and uphold their legacy. And we call on Palestinian youth and Arabs all across the world to play an active role in our struggle for national liberation.
Activists from a wide range of organizations are calling on Canadians to support Palestinian resistance by opposing Canada's contribution to Palestinian dispossession and joining the demand to end the illegal occupation. Camila Escalante, Toronto.
Amid contradictory reports on the contents of the Egyptian-mediated ceasefire between Palestinian resistance group Islamic Jihad in the besieged Gaza Strip and Israel, Palestinian experts say that the Israeli regime is to abide by the agreement, at least for the time being, but they add that it's unclear how long the latest ceasefire will hold before the regime breaches it. Israel's seriousness will be determined to some extent by the length of the period of calm, they say.
Whether the Israelis are going to commit to this ceasefire, as we know that this is not the first time we have truce or ceasefire. It happened hundreds of times before, and all the time it was Israel who broke this kind of agreement, not just because the Palestinians do anything, but because the Israeli themselves and in this kind of regime, the colonial racist regime, it's used to that.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, during a cabinet meeting on Sunday, told his ministers that the Israeli military took out the entire leadership of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad and, by doing so, fulfilled the goals of the so-called Shield and Arrow operation in perfect form. He also claimed that Tel Aviv had changed the equation and thwarted the entire top of the jihad movement. Meanwhile, Israel's far-right minister Itamar Ben-Gvir has demanded that targeted killing be carried out against Palestinian resistance leaders in the West Bank as well. He added that the last operation was good and important, but it must be continued.
The most important thing is that the Israeli regime failed to achieve any political goal, failed in restoring deterrence, failed in oppressing the resistance or creating a fraction between the Palestinians themselves or between different factions. Netanyahu has maybe temporarily succeeded in regaining his popularity. However, he will face his problems within days. This round is failure to Israel.
Analysts, meanwhile, say one of the reasons Netanyahu agreed to the ceasefire is Thursday's controversial flag march that is held every year by the Israelis to mark the occupation of East Al-Quds in 1967 Six-Day War. This annual event has prompted fightings in past years as the Israeli regime insisted not to reroute the flag march away from the Muslim quarter of Al-Quds. Palestinians wonder whether the Israeli policies and killings in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds would affect in a way or another the inevitability of the ceasefire, mainly after Ben-Gvir's call to assassinate resistance leaders in the West Bank. Mona Qandil, occupied Ramallah.
From the disgrace of the Nakba to today's resistance. The 75th anniversary of the occupation of Palestine is a time to reflect on the long way the oppressed nation of Palestine has come in its struggle for freedom, while shedding light on the numerous instances of human rights violations committed by Israel in the Palestinian territories.
There are over 1,000 Palestinians currently jailed in administrative detention with no charge or no trial under a Zionist regime that can indefinitely extend their detention, leaving them jailed with no charge or no trial for years on end.
The issue of Palestine is the most important issue in the Muslim world, and Nakba is an occasion for all of us to condemn the atrocities against Palestinians. Resistance is the only way to liberate Palestine.
The Nakba has greatly influenced Palestinian culture, and now a new generation of Palestinians is ready to make the ultimate sacrifice in the fight for freedom.
Resistance has paid off. After years of resistance, now we have reached a point where there is no talk about the Greater Israel Project. That image of an invincible army has been shattered.
It's true that the Israeli regime has tried to create the impression that it's strong. We all know that they have the support of world powers. But today, the regime is facing lots of domestic problems. That's mainly the reason for the escalation of raids and attacks in the occupied territories and the Gaza Strip. It's a way to deviate attention from its internal issues. But the international community is now more aware than before.
Today, the word Nakba and what it stands for is known to all who are preoccupied by the Palestinian cause.
This year on May 15th, the United Nations will be holding a high-level special meeting to mark the 75th anniversary of the Nakba. This is the first time that the international body is marking the date, recognizing the historic injustice suffered by the Palestinian people. Gizumisha Ahmadi, Tehran.
It was a gathering of defiance and hope, a chance for pro-Palestinian organizations and supporters to remind the international community they have not forgotten about justice for Palestine. 75 years on from the catastrophe, there was an urgent message for the world.
Today, and our first message is one of solidarity to the Palestinian people, those across historic Palestine from the river to the sea, those in the diaspora. The Palestinians expelled in 1948 and their descendants, who today are marking what happened in 1948, the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians, the destruction of more than 500 Palestinian villages, but are also marking the Nakba not as a moment rooted in the past, but an ongoing process of colonization, a dispossession and oppression.
Ongoing Israeli aggression and injustices mean the Nakba is not simply a historic moment, but one that demands an immediate response to the current situation.
The Nakba is ongoing, and we have seen the latest threads in that tapestry of the Nakba woven in Gaza, once again suffering the raining of Israeli bombs.
The international community continues to fail the Palestinians, not just for their role in the facilitation of the ethnic cleansing and displacement of the people, but for their continued political blind eye, a blind eye that allows Israel to act with impunity in its subjugation and oppression of Palestinians day in, day out.
Britain's role in not just pushing through the Balfour Agreement, but London's current position as a staunch ally of Tel Aviv makes the demands of the marchers all the more pressing.
What we're asking for as a British public is sanctions on Israel. We're asking for international law to be upheld. If any other country was breaking this many laws this frequently on an international level, sanctions would be placed upon them without doubt. So we're asking for level playing field here, international law to be applied to Israel, sanctions on Israel now. The Nakba isn't a historical fact. It's a fact that's going on right now.
We want to see an end to UK-Israeli weapons trade going both directions, actually. It's not just a one-way street. We want to see an end to that. And we want to really call our government to account for its complicity, not only in the arms trade and so on, but the continuing repression within Gaza and within the occupied territories. Really, 75 years is way too long. It's 75 years too long. And we want to see the restoration of freedom and liberty to the Palestinian peoples, to their lands and to their state.
As Palestinians continue to resist the occupation with every resource available to them, those demonstrating are keen to show the spirit of solidarity across the globe remains steadfast. Amina Taylor, London.
Thousands marched in Paris to commemorate 75 years since the Palestinian Nakba, which means catastrophe, the imperialist slaughter and theft by Israelis on a horrific scale in 1948. To achieve their goal of conquering Palestine, Israelis immediately turned 800,000 Palestinians into homeless refugees, used ethnic cleansing to destroy over 400 villages, and massacred over 15,000 people. Since then, Israelis have forcibly displaced a stunning 14 million Palestinians, jailed over 1 million people, and launched an average of 10 police raids every single day. The cruelty Israel has shown towards Palestinians for 75 years has been unending, and the path to justice seems like a long road.
Firstly, it means the end of occupation, because you can always imagine a reconciliation between the rapist and its victim. But this can never happen during the rape. The rape has to cease. And this is the first step.
Even though Muslims outnumber Jews in France by 15-1, their support of Palestine is not democratically reflected. Paris has long considered itself as Europe's primary diplomat on the world stage, but many say they do nothing to rein in Israel's daily atrocities and falsely label Palestinian supporters as being against Judaism and Jews.
To label people who defend Palestinians as anti-Semites is a well-known strategy from the Zionist lobby, from the government of Israel, in order to suppress the struggle for sovereignty in Palestine, the human rights in Palestine. Even human rights organizations in Israel are labeled as anti-Semite for defending Palestinian rights and exposing Israeli crimes. This kind of label we cannot accept.
Rarely admitted in the Western media, but common knowledge globally, Israel has turned Gaza into the world's largest prison, where hundreds of Palestinians are murdered by Israelis each year for their land, homes, and beliefs. Israel is currently waging one of its nearly annual wars on Gaza and have killed dozens and wounded over 150 people in the past several days. As many Palestinians remind, the Nakba is ongoing, even if the West would like to ignore it. On May 15th, the United Nations will, for the first time ever, commemorate the massacre, theft, and genocide of 75 years ago. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Only weeks after he said the UK economy might have turned a corner, this announcement by the Bank of England's governor.
But let me be clear, inflation remains too high, and it's our job to get it all the way down to the 2% target and have it stay there. And this is why today we've increased bank rate by 0.25 percentage points to 4.5%.
Since it took measures to tackle the pace of price rises in the UK, the bank has now raised interest rates multiple times, raising questions among economists such as Professor Keith Pilbeam about the efficacy of the move.
Well, today's interest rate rise is just another indication of the failure of the Bank of England to do its job earlier. And had it raised interest rates well before it started raising them and raised them more substantially, we probably wouldn't be headed to even higher rates down the road, and certainly inflation would have been brought back under control.
The rate rise will have consequences, economists say, for other sectors of the economy, such as the housing market, where 2.5 million Britons will soon have to renew their home loans at higher interest rates. For months, increases in wholesale energy prices caused by self-imposed sanctions over the war in Ukraine were blamed for the unbridled inflation here. Energy prices have since eased, but inflation hasn't.
Well, what did Rishi Sunak do when he was Chancellor of the Exchequer? He borrowed well over £300 billion, increasing the fiscal deficit to 15% of GDP. How was that financed? It wasn't financed through tax rises. It wasn't financed through some sort of government cuts or anything like that. It was financed purely by printing of money by the Bank of England. £300 billion in one go, raising the UK money supply from £600 billion to £900 billion in the space of 1 year.
Rampant inflation has seen grocery prices shoot up by up to 20%. The demand for food banks doubled compared to 5 years ago, and months of public sector strikes for pay rises.
This is the 12th consecutive interest rate rise in less than 2 years, with the Bank of England leaving the door open for more hikes in the coming months. The question now is, when will the bank hit the pause button? Syed Pourreza, London.
The Limelight.
The latest government statistical data in England show that the price of food has risen sharply. The continuation of this situation has put the focus on food insecurity in Britain. We take a look at some of the world media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Independent has covered this story and tells us more. Experts have warned slashing the cost of food, fruit and vegetables to ease the cost of living crisis should be on the table at Downing Street's food summit in the coming days. Britain's Prime Minister Rishi Sunak is facing calls to urge supermarkets to halve what they charge amid stubbornly high inflation rates. Retailers have privately told ministers that food prices have peaked and will start to fall significantly in the coming months. But that will do little to help those battling soaring bills. With warnings, even middle-class families are struggling. Farmers, retailers and others from across the UK food chain have been invited to a summit at No. 10 Downing Street. The meeting was reportedly brought forward after food inflation hit another high last month. Professor Tim Lang, a former government advisor, said one message that Prime Minister Rishi Sunak could deliver at the meeting was, he could say, right, I want you to halve the prices on key fruit, vegetable and hydrocarbons like potatoes. The British government's former food czar, Henry Dimbleby, stated that politicians need to be making fruit and vegetable much cheaper for those who can't afford it. Official figures put food and drink price inflation at more than 19.2% in the year to March, almost twice the overall headline inflation rate. The hikes have been given by soaring energy costs and disruption to the supply chain caused by the Russia-Ukraine conflict. Rising wages, difficult weather conditions which have affected harvests and trade barriers caused by Brexit have all been blamed as factors for rising cost of living. Professor Tim Lang said he was part of a cost of living commission in a London borough which had heard evidence of people going without meals for days. He also warned of what he said was the worsening affordability of even middle-class people to eat a decent diet. The government's former food czar, Henry Dimbleby, stated that he backed a targeted approach, adding, you need to direct support at the families who are really struggling. Dimbleby warned that it would not be right for the better off to also receive subsidised fruit and vegetables. His recommendations to the government included a community Eat Well programme, designed to support those on low incomes to improve their diets. Experts warn any changes to the UK supply chain will take time to affect consumers. Prices are already a source of tension between supermarkets and the farmers who produce much of what they see on their shelves. According to reports, the No. 10 Downing Street event will feature speeches and breakout sessions on key themes. There will also be a showcase of great British food and drink businesses and innovators. A government spokesperson said, our UK Farm to Fork Summit will bring together government and representatives from across the food supply chain to step up cooperation and promote all elements of our world-renowned farming and food industries. The government spokesperson added, the event will look at how we can champion UK food and drink both at home and abroad by boosting confidence, helping more businesses to invest in domestic food production and supporting the long-term resilience and sustainability of the UK food sector. Bloomberg News Agency has also covered this story and tells us more. According to a report, rising grocery prices in the UK have replaced energy as the main inflationary concern for the Bank of England. Although energy prices have slightly declined, British families are facing a tight squeeze on their finances due to double-digit inflation. Low- and middle-income families are being hit the hardest, given that they spend the bulk of their income on essentials and are now seeing a dramatic increase in their shopping bills. According to the Bank of England, food inflation has been particularly high, reaching 19.1% in March. Over the past year, grocery price growth in the United Kingdom has been at its highest level since records began. According to Bloomberg News Agency, it has now replaced energy costs as the most important financial issue for the public. The Governor of the Bank of England, Andrew Bailey, told reporters recently We're acutely aware of how difficult this rise in food prices is for people, especially for those on lower incomes. Andrew Bailey added, I expect food price inflation to start slowing down soon, but I admit that it is taking longer than we previously thought. Meanwhile, economists say it has become difficult to argue where prices will go at a time of major supply disruptions caused by the conflict in Ukraine in today's modern interconnected world. According to the Bloomberg News Agency, this has meant that Bank of England lacks past experience for making food price forecasts. The Bank of England's recent monetary policy report said the sustained higher price level represents a long-term cost for households and businesses, and this is one driver of subdued economic activity over the forecast horizon. According to Bloomberg, even with lower energy costs, it will take time for food producers such as farmers, who often buy key suppliers like fertilizers in advance, to adjust prices and make their goods more affordable to consumers. The British newspaper The Morning Star has also covered this story and tells us more. New research suggests that one in three young people say their family have relied on food banks or other community outlets for supplies in recent months. The co-op and children's charity, Barnardo's, said their study of 5,000 individuals between the ages of 10 and 25 found the stark impact the cost of living crisis was having on the access to food and mental well-being of young people and children. The report said almost half of young people have worried about being able to afford things in the past 6 months, with one in three saying their family has used food support, such as a community fridge or a food bank. Almost one in four said they have started the day without a meal. The study also found that the rising cost of living is having a significant knock-on impact on young people's life goals, as making it through day by day takes priority. The report said having enough money to cover basic needs has become the most common aspiration for most young people, overtaking other traditional goals such as achieving their dream job or buying a house. Only 2 in 4 of those surveyed said they believe it is likely they will be able to have enough money to cover basic needs in the future. Shireen Khourihab, chief executive of Co-op Group, says, the cost of living has had a seismic impact on young people, with many having to prioritise immediate needs, like where their next meal will come from, over long-term goals and their aspirations. Shireen Khourihab added, remarkably, despite all of this, young people continue to show resilience and ambition to create a better future, but all too often they're cut out of important discussions and policy-making decisions that directly impact them. She added, we know that taking a grassroots approach and giving young people a voice on the issues which affect them will drive better long-term outcomes for them and their communities. Lynn Perry, chief executive of the charity Barnardo's, said, we know from our frontline work supporting children and families across the United Kingdom that too many are struggling to access the very basics, including food, and there's an increasing impact on their mental well-being and their opportunities. Lynn Perry added, worryingly, our new research with Co-op shows that young people seem to be losing hope and do not feel optimistic about their future.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Spotlight, I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, it has been 15 months since the start of the Russian-Ukraine war, and still there is no end in sight. Moscow initiated intensive attacks on Ukraine overnight. Even the head of Kiev's military administration has written that Russia had conducted an integrated attack in the Ukrainian capital, describing it as exceptional in its density. All of this as Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has been making his rounds in Western capitals and ramping up more support for Kiev in anticipation of an upcoming Ukrainian counteroffensive. Well, what does it all mean? We're going to be taking a look at that on this Spotlight. I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. Out of New York, Andrew Dobryansky, Communication Director, Ukrainian Congress Committee of America. And Daniel McAdams, Executive Director, Ron Paul Institute, Lake Jackson, Texas. Thank you both for being with me. Well, let's start this off in New York. And Andre, do you think this war could have been avoided to begin with? What would have had to have happened to avoid it?
The entire world was warning the Russian Federation not to do what it did. And the Russian Federation lied repeatedly to the world that it would not do what it has done. In fact, Russia was chairing the UN Security Council in February of 2022, seemingly thumbing its nose at all international conventions. We know what would have prevented this is if the world had acted sooner in stopping Putin's ambitions, whether it was his first, his 50th, his 100th political assassination throughout the world, whether it was bombing campaigns on his own territory, invading other sovereign countries, and letting it finally come to the largest country in Europe. Now we see how much work there is to make sure that the international order is restored, and that, frankly, is going to be the best way to ensure that future conflicts like this won't happen.
Daniel, your assessment of it all, do you think that this could have been avoided?
Absolutely, it could have been avoided. You have to go back to at least 2014 and maybe down to the end of the Cold War, when NATO should have been disbanded as the Warsaw Pact was disbanded. Its reason for existing ceased at the conclusion of the Cold War. But at the very least, you can go to U.S. interventionist foreign policy in the region, U.S. involvement in the Orange Revolution in the early 2000s in Ukraine set the stage for what we finally saw in Maidan, which was a U.S.-backed coup against a democratically elected government. Excuse me?
You're using disinformation there. I'm sorry.
Okay, Andre, just let Daniel talk. I'll give you a chance to respond.
Why don't you just relax for a second, okay? U.S.-backed coup. We saw the U.S. senators, John McCain and others, taking the stage. We saw Victoria Nuland, who now has a senior position in the State Department. They were obsessed with overthrowing the government in Ukraine because their real target was overthrowing the government in Russia. So they've used Ukraine, sadly enough, as a battlefield for their desire to regime change Russia. And now hundreds of thousands of Ukrainians have died in it. So yes, it could have been stopped if the U.S. did not pursue an interventionist foreign policy and stop trying to rule the world.
Andrei, what did you want to say? Go ahead.
I'm sorry, you need to correct the record about this coup language. This is a live-streamed event that happened over the course of 5 months from November through February, and encampments remained throughout most of Ukraine throughout the end of March. I was there personally. So we can argue about foreign policy intervention, but using the words that the Russian Federation used as a pretense for their invasion is clearly a bit of disinformation. So that's what we need to make sure we're correcting the record there.
Okay, well,
you're not correcting anything because you're wrong. You don't correct somebody. You're wrong. It was a coup in 2014. It has nothing
Were
to do with
there?
What the Russians said.
Have you
so
been
what?
To Ukraine?
So what?
Have you been
so
to
what?
Ukraine? Have you been to Ukraine?
What does that have to do with
okay,
anything?
Let's stay on topic. I don't think we have to visit a particular place to have a perspective. But let's look at the overall situation. Andre, would the United States have allowed a hostile power to put missiles on its borders? Let's start from there.
What missiles were put into Ukraine?
I want to know, as NATO expanded eastwards, okay, and in Russia continued to say about the threats that were coming closer and closer to its border, would the United States allow a hostile power to be on its border? Let's start from there. In Mexico,
again,
in Canada.
No countries were hostile to Russia prior to the invasion. There were no missiles put onto Ukrainian territory. And in fact, over five bilateral treaties were broken between Ukraine and Russia. No defensive armaments and placements were on Ukraine's border with Russia. This is, you know, clearly not a great analogy if you're talking about the former friendship treaty between Russia and Ukraine that was violated by Russia in 2014 and continues to be violated every day. It's been recognized by the UN Security Council. It's been recognized by a majority of United Nations member nations. I think it's very obvious what the facts are on the ground.
Well, Andre, had not NATO agreed, we go back to the 90s and United States and NATO had agreed not to expand east. And if we look at from the disintegration of the Soviet Union and we look at it and we bring it on up till today, the number of countries that have actually joined NATO and that the Russians felt that it was a threat and that the United States and the NATO countries were not keeping its word. Because there are some who say that after the disintegration of the Soviet Union, the Cold War was over. There was actually no reason for NATO to exist because we know the Warsaw Pact at that point was dismantled. So there are many that would say there was no reason for it to exist. So do you not agree that NATO did not keep its word, that the United States did not keep its word about eastward expansion?
I don't know what document you're citing about keeping its word. I did cite several international agreements between Russia and Ukraine, international multilateral agreements by all member nations of the United Nations, the Helsinki Final Act, numerous transgressions that were made by this invasion.
Okay.
Whereas keeping the peace in Europe through multilateral treaties, which is what NATO is, keeping the peace in Europe for the longest period of time in all of history is the benefit for all mankind so that we don't have another world war. That was the whole purpose for setting up these international multilateral agreements.
Okay.
And so that's what we need to recognize when we're talking about what happened, what exists in Europe today.
All right,
and
let me get Daniel back in on this conversation. Stay with me, Andre.
Okay.
Daniel, go ahead. Your thoughts.
Well, we already know from history what would happen, and it wasn't even on our border. It was when the Soviet Union attempted to put missiles in Cuba, 90 miles off of our border, and the U.S. was ready to go to nuclear war with the Soviet Union at the time. So it's obvious, it's very, very clear that the U.S. will not tolerate a hostile neighbor that's well-armed by a far, you know, thousands of miles away partner. It's something the U.S. wouldn't tolerate. The U.S. practically went insane a few months ago when it thought some Chinese balloons were flying overhead. So the fact is, it wouldn't tolerate it. We know for a fact that the gentleman in New York, whatever his name is wrong, because we know that from 14 up until the Russians moved in, that NATO was arming and training Ukrainian soldiers to fight Russia. Angela Merkel herself said it, the reason why Minsk 1 and 2 were not implemented, we wanted to have some extra time so that we could move more weapons and do more training. The goal was always to overthrow Russia. You can't sow the wind and be upset when you reap the whirlwind, because that's exactly what's happening. If you move missiles, if you bring countries into an alliance that's aimed against Russia, and then finally at the very end, at the very last, when you've been warned 15 or 20 times and you punch someone in the face and they punch back, you can't say, well, gosh, that doesn't seem fair. You know, it's not rocket science here.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Andre, is the United States using Ukraine to fight its proxy war against Russia?
I don't know what to say about that. I mean, this is not punching people in the face. This is genocide. This is women over the age of 80 getting repeatedly raped next to their husbands.
Yeah.
Children as young as...
Cut the propaganda.
Children,
you know?
Children
whatever
as young
talking
as four,
points you're getting from your buddies in
children
D.C.
as young as 4 years old being sexually violated by Russian soldiers. And this has nothing to do about people's feelings.
The woman who brought that up was in the UN, and it was already completely debunked. I mean, this is a waste of time. I mean, these are talking points that are handed to you by the neocons in D.C.
That's
okay, stay with me, Daniel. Go ahead, Andre. I'll give you a chance, Daniel.
Again, we're talking about an existing multilateral set of rules for everybody to partake in. What happened in Ukraine is that its sovereignty was violated, as other neighbors of Russia's sovereignty
by
was violated. This has nothing
yeah,
to
I'm
do.
With you there.
This has nothing to do with missiles being placed there, because no nuclear missiles were placed in Ukraine. And if we're talking about countries who should be afraid, it is the countries and the neighbors of Ukraine, which rightfully felt that it's best to be in a military alliance where if you attack one, you attack all. And that is what Ukraine has made very clear by being in support of all NATO missions since 1996. This was made very clear at the Bucharest summit in 2008. Ukraine has constantly been deploying their own soldiers in support of other missions throughout the world. It signed on as the first nation. Next year will mark 30 years since Ukraine signed on to the NATO Partnership for Peace.
Okay.
This was the real dismantling of terror within Europe and making sure that countries work with each other. And it is one country above all, one country that has begun to invade other countries and must be stopped by the international community.
All right, Daniel, let me get you back in on this. Go ahead, Daniel.
Well, the fact is very clear. The U.S. was behind a coup in 2014, as the U.S. has done, certainly under the Obama administration, in places like Syria and in Libya and elsewhere. The U.S. was determined, and this is a doctrine of the neocons, determined to maintain itself as a hyperpower, and taking down Russia as a threat, and now taking down China as a threat, are clearly on their radar. You know, NATO is not a defensive alliance. Ask any Libyan how it feels about NATO. Ask any Serbian how it feels about NATO as a defensive alliance. It's clearly an offensive alliance. The reason again, the war is happening is U.S. involvement, U.S. meddling, the attempt to take down, and also countries like the Baltics and the Poles attempting to settle old scores, maybe get a little bit of territory out of this whole thing in the end. Certainly the Poles are hungry for Western Ukraine. So the whole issue could have been avoided. It was unnecessary. The problem is you have a lot of extremists in Ukraine. They like to wear these funny symbols on their shirts that mark back to a previous time in history. They like the SS. They like the Nazis. And that's a real problem.
I mean, Andre, we're talking about... Daniel, talk... One second, Andre. Daniel was talking about 2014. One second, please. Stay with me. Daniel was talking about 2014. I want to go back to 2014 because we know, I think we all recall the leaked conversation by the Assistant U.S. Secretary at the time, Victoria Nuland, and basically very much showed that the U.S. was very much involved in that situation that was taking place in Ukraine, and basically said to F the EU, if we recall, basically what she said. So how can you not say that the U.S. Was behind, whether we're talking about the 2014 coup, and so many of the things that have happened since then? Is it not that the Ukrainian people are actually being used by the Americans in this situation? Your assessment.
Ma'am, I must ask you to correct yourself when you're using words like coup. The international record does not reflect that.
Agree with me. Oh, my God.
Correct yourself.
The international record does not reflect that. We saw that
Which
for
record?
5 months. And again,
Which record?
And again, if you were there in Ukraine, you would know all of the conversations that were happening for 5 months instead of this one conversation that you seem to cite that was released by the Russian government.
It's very inconvenient for you, isn't it?
As opposed to 24 hours of people occupying squares throughout all of Ukraine, from the westernmost part to the easternmost part, people putting themselves into danger.
What about the snipers at the end? What about the snipers in
the end? People putting themselves into danger after every night. There are still hundreds of people who remain disappeared from the very beginning in November and December of 2013 that we still do not know where they were disappeared to, where they are buried, where their bodies are. This revolution is a revolution for dignity that began with ordinary citizens standing in the middle of the street, as opposed to what you seem to be citing, which is one conversation from February reacting
Andre,
to
it's
an
not one conversation. There are many records with this. And, of course,
there.
When you start with 2013 and we can look at 2014, we could look at the Donbass, and we have so much information in dealing with that. But let me concentrate on what is happening right now. With what is happening right now, Daniel, and Western nations committing more money and more powerful and long-range weapons to Ukraine. How do you see this? Do you think that this will actually help Kiev gain the upper hand in the war? Or is this simply just prolonging the war and increasing the fatalities? How do you see it, Daniel?
That's exactly what it is. Ukraine had no chance from the very beginning, and I think the U.S. knew it and didn't care. NATO knew it and didn't care. There's no way Ukraine can win. We've seen endless waves of new wonder weapons. It was going to be, you know, this and that and the other. Now it's going to be this. They've not made a choice. They've not made a difference because Russia views this as an existential war, a war of choice on the part of NATO and the U.S. So, no, it will not change the tide. We've just seen Bakhmut fall nearly today. I think there's one building left. Bakhmut falls, and then the whole line of defense falls. And then we'll see what happens from there. But thousands and thousands of young men, and very young men, who you can see them being snatched off the streets in Ukraine by the thugs who are forcing them into conscription. You're seeing old men being forced into conscription to fight and die for a thugocracy.
Why would the United States do this?
Well, Victoria said it, F the EU. I mean, that's exactly what the U.S. has done. They've F the EU completely. I mean, Germany is now a deindustrialized country. It's a third world country in Europe. I never thought I would see that happen. The U.K. is not far behind. So it's a mad dash to maintain world hegemony. But in the meantime, the whole world is de-dollarizing, and that is also an avoidable outcome of this ridiculous U.S. attempt to overthrow the Russian government. It's going to be the end of the U.S. economy as well. So the world is changing completely and fundamentally. It's not just in Ukraine. The entire global South, you have Iran and Saudi Arabia talking to each other, reestablishing diplomatic relations in Syria. And all of this is in response to what's happening with the U.S. and NATO goading and destroying Ukraine in an attempt to get to Russia.
Okay. Andre, how likely is it that this war could actually expand and directly involve other countries and the danger of all of this?
This war has already affected other countries. Obviously, first and foremost, with the countries who are spending a percentage of their GDP in supporting Ukraine. But more importantly, the people who are struggling with malnutrition and lack of food, that has already led to some governments being destabilized throughout the world, specifically in South Asia. The governments of North Africa and the Middle East are very much being looked at, given the fact that the amount of food supplied by both Ukraine and Russia to those regions has been drastically cut down because of this unnecessary war, this unprovoked genocidal attack on Ukraine that has spiraled into consequences for other nations. And that is part of the reason that the entire United Nations, the vast majority of nations, 141 nations, have voted to make sure that the grain transit from the south of Ukraine through the Black Sea is uninterrupted, and it remains blocked by the Russian Federation to this day.
Well, Daniel, as Western forces seem to be cranking up the war machine even more, We have countries in the global south, some African countries and China now, that are trying to push for peace. Both Russia and Ukraine have agreed to talk to these both groups. Let's talk about these efforts and the possibility that this could be resolved diplomatically.
I mean, the Chinese have come through, and it's not really a peace plan, but it's a proposal to begin discussions and talk about security, talk about regional security, which is what President Putin asked for before they decided to go into Ukraine. Let's have a discussion about security. We are tired of NATO expanding up to our borders. We are tired of these countries getting armed. We're tired of Poland and Romania having missiles aimed at Moscow and St. Petersburg. We need to talk about it because it's unnecessary. We need to stop escalating the war talk on the part of NATO. And nobody listened. They refused to listen. They refused to take him seriously. Oh, he's bluffing. He's bluffing. They say, no, this is an existential issue for us. We don't want to be surrounded by a hostile NATO. And no one listened. And now we're seeing what happens when you do something very stupid that doesn't help our country whatsoever. It doesn't help Western Europe whatsoever. And then you blow up the pipeline so they can't even get oil. So it's an absolute disaster. The U.S. foreign policy, as you know, is run by neocons. They have no reverse gear. They only know how to accelerate, and that's why I fear for the future of the world. And I hope to God that the Chinese and the Africans do find some way to settle this peacefully in a way that Russia feels like its security is guaranteed, and whatever remains, if anything remains of Ukraine, can also live in peace.
Andrei, what about you? Are you optimistic about these two groups and trying to reach some type of diplomatic agreement? Where do you see all of this going at this point in time?
At this point in time, there have been significant military gains by Ukraine throughout this past month. We saw that the main river in the country, the Dnipro, had been crossed by Ukraine's armed forces in the south. The majority of Bakhmut, those forces have fallen away, given the fact that they're private contractors by Russia who are fleeing the conflict as we speak. So the fact is that the military equipment and armaments that have been provided by Ukraine's allies have really helped Ukraine in fact of getting its sovereignty back. That will be the end point of this conflict, will be all of Ukraine's territory being recognized as it is by the world today, by almost every international body recognizing that there is sovereign territory and that belongs to Ukraine.
Okay.
Hey, I got $100, I'll bet you on that one, right? I'm happy to make a couple $100 off of this.
And Daniel,
I do not bet on genocide. This is you know, really beneath a civil discussion.
Daniel,
hey,
Daniel, where do you see this going to end this war?
Unfortunately for Ukraine, it's going to get worse unless they realize that they are run by a corrupt dictatorship in Kiev who does not give a darn about citizens. The real power in Ukraine is held by psychopaths and Nazis. The opposition parties are banned. Any non-state media is panned. They even went after the church and are hassling and forbidding the practice of religion. If this is our democratic ally, I would hate to see